under advisement, and we move to the case number two, U.S. versus Longstreet.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Dan Cordes, and I'm here this morning on behalf of appellant Mr. Ray Longstreet. Mr. Longstreet was tried and convicted on several counts of an indictment, most notably on count one for conspiracy to possess and distribute certain controlled substances. Now, in its indictment, the government chose, with the conspiracy count, to charge upwards of 30 defendants with a single overarching conspiracy. The government also chose to place Mr. Longstreet at the head of that entire conspiracy. Now, the evidence at trial was only sufficient, at most, to show that there were two or more separate conspiracies, and Mr. Longstreet was only involved with a portion of the entire single overarching conspiracy allegation in count one. I wanted to spend my limited time here today, Your Honors, to directly focus in on the legal standards with conspiracy and how I don't think that the evidence satisfied that standard. In the Stigler case, and in many cases, it's fundamental conspiracy case law that the two co-conspirators must be either mutually dependent on one another or they have to show mutual support. Now, as you can see throughout the briefs, Anthony Sutton was tied to Mr. Longstreet by the government during trial. Had Anthony Sutton's crack cocaine sales not been attributed to Mr. Longstreet, he would not have been convicted on count one, and certainly the sentencing picture would have been much different. So Anthony Sutton is critical here for Mr. Longstreet. So mutual dependence. There was no evidence presented at trial that Anthony Sutton's crack cocaine sales and business depended on Ray Longstreet at all. How do we know that? One, when Anthony Sutton opened up his drug spot, Ray Longstreet was still serving a 10-year sentence in Illinois State Prison. The evidence showed that Mr. Longstreet maybe used a telephone four times in the last 2 years of that sentence. But Anthony Sutton, he's opening his drug spot out on the streets. He's not depending on Ray Longstreet. When Longstreet gets out of Illinois State Prison after being gone for 10 years, there's no evidence that he was really communicating with the outside world, he's immediately on house arrest. He's homebound, the evidence showed, only getting out a few hours a week. So Anthony Sutton certainly was not depending on Ray Longstreet's help to run his drug business.
Why was he paying him rent money then?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you mentioned the street tax or the street rent. And the evidence relating to that is when Anthony Sutton supposedly started paying his street tax, his street rent, Ray Longstreet's in jail. Now, the argument from the government is that, well, his surrogates were collecting it on his behalf and using his name as force or the hammer to collect that street rent. Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record that Ray Longstreet is making jailhouse calls or has jailhouse visitors where he's telling people to collect street rent. There's no evidence of it. There's no evidence that Ray Longstreet is receiving any of the street rent either. The best that the evidence shows on that for purposes of the government's case is Anthony Sutton assumed that Ray Longstreet was receiving those payments. There is not a shred of evidence to show that, to link that. Ray Longstreet is sitting in Illinois State Prison under highly confining conditions, and the evidence shows he's not communicating with the outside world. So I don't think the evidence was sufficient on that point to show that Anthony Sutton was paying street rent to Ray Longstreet, or if he was paying them to his surrogates, as you see in our briefs, maybe they're using his name to collect it, but there's no evidence that Ray Longstreet's saying, go ahead, it's okay, use my name, they'll pay you if you drop my name. The evidence just isn't sufficient on that point, Your Honor. And I think critically, getting back to the mutual dependence point, Anthony Sutton has his own group of cocaine suppliers. Evidence doesn't show that Ray Longstreet knows anything about him, doesn't know him, doesn't deal with him. There's no evidence that Ray Longstreet shuttles customers over to Anthony Longstreet. There's no evidence that Anthony Sutton really lets Ray Longstreet in on any part of his business. And I think this is critical. The following point, Your Honors, there is no evidence presented at trial that Anthony Sutton and Ray Longstreet divvy up the money. There is no evidence of that. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary, and that is Ray Longstreet, the evidence shows, is struggling to make his monthly bill payments. Anthony Sutton testifies, on the other hand, that he's made millions of dollars in the drug industry. There's just such a disconnect there, Your Honor, that the evidence was insufficient to show that these two guys are in business together, that they depended on one another. Now, Your Honor, I actually forgot to mention something in relation to the street tax or the street rent. Government argues, the evidence at trial says, well, Ray Longstreet knew about the street rent because when he got out, he told Anthony Sutton that he didn't have to pay it anymore. Well, and that all Anthony Sutton had to do was help him out if Ray Longstreet was in a pinch, give him a loan, lend him a few $100, help him out. Well, Your Honors, Ray Longstreet went to Anthony Sutton at some point in time and asked for that loan. Anthony Sutton simply refused. There was no sorry, can't help you out. That evidence is just insufficient of those two guys being business partners.
Well, but if he said he didn't have to pay it, it means he felt he did have to pay it to him in the first place, right?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence showed that actually Anthony Sutton testified that it was Kenneth Wallace that authorized him to start operating that drug spot. He was paying his money to Kenneth Wallace. He was paying his money to Michael Irvin. And when Ray Longstreet gets out, he says, you don't have to pay it anymore. I think the critical point here for the court is the government just doesn't introduce any evidence to show that any of this money makes its way to Ray Longstreet. And kind of the global point of all this is that how does Ray Longstreet benefit from Anthony Sutton's crack cocaine sales? He has, if they're going to be co-conspirators, the evidence has just got to show that Ray Longstreet's benefiting. The evidence just doesn't show that. Again, they're not divvying up profits. They're not helping each other out with loans. I think that's a critical point here, a critical gaping hole in the evidence. And in the same vein, there's no evidence that Longstreet, other than one purchase of crack cocaine, is really relying on Anthony Sutton to run his drug dealing business. Ray Longstreet, the evidence showed, was dealing in some heroin, but Anthony Sutton wasn't his supplier. Anthony Sutton wasn't selling Ray Longstreet's drugs. They just weren't depending on each other. Now, Your Honors, as the court knows, a variance in the evidence that shows multiple conspiracies versus the charged single conspiracies won't get Mr. Longstreet there at the end of the day. There has to be prejudice shown. There has to be prejudice from that variance. And, Your Honors, that prejudice flowed from the lack of a limiting instruction given by the trial court that says the evidence at trial showed as a matter of law that no single overarching conspiracy as charged was proven. And therefore, the jury cannot consider the activities of other conspiracies, of other co-conspirators, of other people for purposes of either convicting Mr. Longstreet or sentencing him. That instruction was not given. So the jury was allowed to consider all of Anthony Sutton's crack cocaine sales, an extensive business. He was allowed to consider the gang-related and violent activities of other people, shoplifting of other people. The government introduced over 100 telephone calls, many of which did not involve Ray Longstreet. The jury heard all that, and with the lack of a limiting instruction, they were allowed to consider all that. And that's prejudicial to Mr. Longstreet.
Well, that doesn't sound like the standard multiple conspiracy instruction. Is there any legal support for that sort of instruction?
Well, yes, certainly there is, Your Honor. For example, the Lindsay case, United States versus Lindsay, the Rosnow case, the Stigler case, which
those
are all cited in our briefs.
Those cases support instructing the jury that the evidence shows as a matter of law that there isn't one overarching conspiracy? That sounds like directed verdict.
No, Your Honors, the legal standard would be if the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law to prove the single overarching conspiracy, then the defendant should get the benefit of an instruction that says the jury should not consider evidence other than what exactly the defendant did. They should not be allowed to consider evidence of other conspiracies activities. And I believe that you'll find that in the, for example, the Lindsay case. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Handelsman.
May it please the Court, Robert Handelsman for Zepeda. I have a cold today, so please bear with me. Now, we pointed out in footnote 1 of the reply brief that the transcript is unclear as to exactly what Zepeda admitted at his plea. We can't tell whether Zepeda admitted to AUSA's proffer of evidence or Judge Cannelli's recapitulation of that evidence, which excluded the 3 kilograms within a month, which seems to be what this case turns on. Your cases require a sentencing judge to decide which statement to believe when a witness makes contradictory statements at sentencing. The same principle should apply where there's contradictory evidence at sentencing, and the district court does not state which evidence it accepts. Your cases require quantities to be based on the most conservative evidence using the minimum and the smallest quantities. You cannot honor the command of these cases by accepting Zepeda's admissions over the PSR. The district court, as trier of fact, can do so. An appeals court cannot. And you cannot affirm because Zepeda's admissions, when viewed in the light most favorable to the government, support the sentence. There is a conflict between the PSR and Zepeda's admissions, and the district court has to resolve that conflict. And due to the McGowan case, the finding of relevant conduct cannot stand. The government makes no effort to justify the relevant conduct on its merits. There is plain error here because there is an insufficient basis in the PSR for the conclusions that it reached. Your decision in Soto Piedra holds that an agent's guesstimate is not a fact upon which a sentence can be based. As far as the appellate process is concerned, what we are dealing with here today, the sentence is based on an incorrect guideline range and is therefore plain error. And the unresolved conflict in the evidence is plain error because Zepeda was not sentenced on the basis of the most conservative view of the evidence. And if relevant conduct is an issue, there's plain error there because of the McGowan case. Thank you.
Ms. Church?
May it please the Court, my name is Megan Church. I'm an assistant United States attorney. Viewed through the lens of a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, there was ample evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Ray Longstreet was a member of the conspiracy charged in the indictment. The jury heard over 100 recorded telephone calls and the testimony of multiple witnesses, including 4 of Mr. Longstreet's co-conspirators. With this evidence, the jury was able to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Mr. Longstreet was a member of the conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute and to distribute controlled substances as charged in the indictment. Specifically, these witnesses proved that Mr. Longstreet was the leader of the West Side faction of the Four Corner Hustlers, and he controlled very specific drug territory in that area. These witnesses, including Anthony Sutton and Tremaine Gray, testified that in order to sell drugs in Mr. Longstreet's territory, his permission was needed. And in exchange for Mr. Longstreet's permission to sell drugs in his territory, these drug dealers needed to pay rent. And there was discussion just a few moments ago about this rent that Mr. Sutton paid to Mr. Longstreet's workers. At the time that Mr. Sutton started paying rent, Mr. Longstreet was in jail. But Mr. Sutton was paying his rent to someone he knew to be one of Mr. Longstreet's workers. His name was Kenneth Wallace. He continued to pay Kenneth Wallace rent until he was told by Kelly Longstreet, Ray Longstreet's brother, to pay the rent to him. So Mr. Sutton started paying rent to Kelly Longstreet. Then once Mr. Longstreet was out of jail, he started paying his rent to Michael Irvin. And as Mr. Sutton testified, Michael Irvin was Mr. Longstreet's enforcer. He was the guy out on the street making sure that rent was paid and that problems were solved for Mr. Longstreet. And it wasn't until Mr. Longstreet told Mr. Sutton that he didn't have to pay this rent anymore that he stopped paying. Based on the rent paid by these drug dealers, or as a result, one of the benefits that Mr. Longstreet offered to these drug dealers was his protection. There was specific testimony from Mr. Sutton regarding some of the protection that Mr. Longstreet afforded him. In particular, there was a situation involving another drug dealer named Paul L. Paul L. owed Anthony Sutton money, and he wasn't paying. Ray Longstreet heard about this, and Ray Longstreet got involved. And there were telephone conversations that the jury heard that Mr. Longstreet and Michael Irvin got in touch with Paul L. And they told him, actually, no, it's not really Anthony Sutton that you owe this money to. You owe this money to me, Ray Longstreet. And Paul L. paid. That was one of the benefits that was offered to Mr. Sutton. Additionally, Mr. Longstreet benefited from having Mr. Sutton sell his drugs in his territory. It kept his customers happy. He was able to keep basically an array of drugs in his territory. And there were numerous calls also discussing between Mr. Longstreet and Mr. Sutton in which Mr. Longstreet tells Anthony Sutton what to do, where to go, where to sell his drugs. In particular, there's call number 103, which is a call between Longstreet and Sutton. It's discussed on pages 461 and 62 of the record, in which Mr. Longstreet tells Mr. Sutton, what I might do is let you go there and let you put your thing down in Pulaski, and I'll just handle Hamlin by myself. As Sutton explained, Longstreet's telling him where to go, where to sell his drugs, move to Pulaski in Iowa. This wasn't a request. It was a direction. There was another call 69, which was also between Mr. Longstreet and Sutton on page 468. Mr. Longstreet tells Mr. Sutton, I'm going to put you and him down on H, and I'm going to pee. And I, because I ain't delivering down there like I need to, you know. Again, Mr. Longstreet is telling Mr. Sutton where to go. And there are more calls similar to that, or in which Mr. Longstreet tells Sutton, go tell this person to sell his drugs out elsewhere, or he can't sell his crack cocaine. In particular, call 2220, which is discussed on page 492 through 495. Again, it's a call between Longstreet and Sutton, in which Longstreet tells Sutton, you tell Studio I said to fall back, and basically not to sell crack cocaine. Studio was Andre Kincaid. He was selling drugs in Longstreet's territory, but according to Mr. Longstreet in this conversation, he was selling the wrong kind of drugs. So he expected Sutton to clear up this mess before he came out. As he said, when I come out, by the time I come around there, it should be cleaned out today. But if it don't, it better be cleaned out by Saturday. You know what I'm saying? Essentially, Longstreet is telling Sutton what to do. He expected his demands to be followed and to be complied with. This is the evidence that was before the jury. Mr. Longstreet has pointed out evidence that suggests that Mr. Longstreet was not all-powerful, all-controlling, but it was for the jury to decide who they believed, what evidence they trusted. And in this case, they found that Mr. Longstreet was a member of the conspiracy charged in the indictment, and that there was a singular conspiracy as charged in the indictment. With regard to the jury instructions, Mr. Longstreet agreed to the instructions as given. There was no other request for any additional instructions as discussed this morning at oral argument. In particular, the defendant, Mr. Longstreet, the court advised the jury that in determining whether Longstreet joined the conspiracy, consider only his words and actions. And then the jury was specifically advised regarding multiple conspiracies. If the conspiracy that they found was not part of that conspiracy, then as charged in count one, then the jury should find the defendant not guilty of that count. The jury was advised correctly. Moving on quickly to Mr. Zepeda's argument, reading through the transcript at a sentencing hearing, Judge Kennelly broke down with the assistant United States attorney each distribution of drugs in particular the kilogram quantities of cocaine, point by point by point. Mr. Zepeda admitted each one. With regard to the pre-sentence investigation report, the government's version followed exactly what Mr. Zepeda admitted. The pre-sentence investigation report, for whatever reason, did not include the single description of within a month he was supplying Sutton with 3 kilos each time. There's no explanation for that. There is no contradiction being suggested by the pre-sentence investigation report. The bottom line was there was no other, and Mr. Zepeda failed to even challenge or object to the pre-sentence investigation report's drug quantity finding. So at the end of the day, even if there was some error, there was no miscarriage of justice. Mr. Zepeda was held responsible for exactly what he already admitted to doing. So unless there are any further questions.
You've already agreed that Irvin should go back for limited remand under Taylor?
That's correct, Judge.
As well as Longstreet?
Yes, with regard to his sentence.
So.
Yes, Judge. The government requests that you affirm the convictions of Ray Longstreet and the sentence of Anselmo Zepeda.
Thank you.
I think the government overstated the contents of that transcript. Go through pages 13 and 18. The AUSA said something. Judge Cannelli tried to recapitulate it. The key issues we have here are the 3 kilograms and the within the month. It was not in the recapitulation. So the record is unclear. It's exactly what he admitted. The prosecutor said something. The judge tried to recapitulate it and then asked Zepeda, is that correct? And he said yes. What is correct? Probably just a recapitulation. But the record is unclear on that. And the fact that it's unclear, the government's whole argument on this issue falls apart. As far as the PSR is concerned, it relied wholesale on the government's version. There's nothing in the law which says a PSR can rely on the government's it becomes gospel just because it comes out of the government's version. The other circuits have a whole litany of cases. They're on pages 12, 13 in the initial brief. And when relying on hearsay in a PSR, what criteria that hearsay has to comply with? That wasn't done here. The fact of the matter is we have a conflict in the evidence between what the PSR says and what Zepeda said. And when I say what Zepeda said, I'm looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. In the government's brief, they cherry-picked the evidence. They cherry-picked the statements as to what to use. Thank you.
Thank you. Both the defense counsel, I think, were appointed in this case. Again, you have the thanks of the court for your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you.